Is it too? There is a light over here, yeah. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a special lecture co-hosted by the Miller Center and by the John Now Center for Civil War History. That's why we're here in the small family collection, special collections. My name, oh, thank you. Wow, there's a light. I was just about to tell you my name, but I couldn't read it. And that helped. The print was too small. My name is Will Hitchcock, and I direct the academic programs at the Miller Center, and I'm also a professor in the history department here at UVA. Well, I don't have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that in about 10 months, one of the people now running for president will take the oath of office. And whether that delights you or terrifies you, I don't know, but it's going to happen, whether we like it or not. And he or she will face a daunting list of serious problems, from foreign crises to domestic turmoil, economic problems, and so forth. But one thing we can take some comfort from is that nothing about that is new. Every new president who comes into office faces a difficult time and a difficult learning curve. And the reason the first year of a presidency is so tricky is because you have to learn on the job. Nobody is really prepared for the pace, the speed, the excitement, the fear of being president of the United States. The new president has to bring in new staff members, some of whom have never really been in the White House before. The new president has to figure out how to work, we hope, with the Congress. The new president has to impose leadership over the armed forces and over the foreign policy bureaucracy, and that can take some time. And perhaps above all, the new president has to perhaps discover, much to his or her chagrin and dismay, that her or his power is actually significantly constrained and curtailed by our Constitution. The president cannot just snap his or her fingers and make things happen. And in proof of this, I will give you the great line that was delivered by Harry Truman, not directly to, but about his successor, Dwight Eisenhower. Truman said about Ike, "Poor Ike. He'll find it isn't a bit like the army. He'll say, do this, do that, and nothing will happen." Well, this year, the Miller Center's been running a research program called The First Year, POTUS 2017. And that project at the Miller Center seeks to illuminate the many policy areas that the next president is likely to face. And we've been developing research teams to look into a whole range of issues, from national security to immigration to racial politics to budget issues to infrastructure, anticipating where the shoe is really going to pinch so that we can brief incoming, we can brief the candidates and brief in the incoming administration. That's our ambition anyway. But we're doing it through what might be called the Miller Center method. We're combing through the historical record to see how past presidents have encountered and struggled with the problems of their first year. What problems did they face? How did they confront and overcome them? And so the theme of our 2016 lecture series in the historical presidency, which many of you have been a part of and have attended earlier iterations of, is this year, From Running to Governing: Presidents and Their First Year in Office. And on our list for this year are six presidents: Jefferson, Lincoln, Kennedy, Nixon, Clinton, and Obama, who've all faced major problems in their first year. And we hope that by looking at their first years, we can gain some insight into what to expect in 2017 as the 45th president takes office. Well, surely, and I'm not stealing Gary's thunder because I anticipate this is what he will say, but surely none of these presidents had as bad a first year as Abraham Lincoln. And to walk us through that difficult time, I think there's going to be more thunder than that in Gary's talk. To walk us through Lincoln's first year, we have one of the world's great experts on the United States Civil War, Gary Gallagher. I think he's well known to you in this audience, but I will briefly introduce him and his co-panelist. Professor Gallagher is the John Now Professor in the History of the American Civil War here at the University of Virginia, and he's also the director of the newly founded John Now Center for Civil War History, which has just opened its offices right here in this building, which is just a wonderful new chapter for Civil War studies here at the university. Gary is the author of major works on the Civil War, including The American War, A History of the Civil War Era, which just came out, co-authored with Joan Waugh, Becoming Confederates, Paths to a New National Loyalty, The Union War, and Causes Won, Lost, and Forgotten, How Hollywood and Popular Art Shape What We Know About the Civil War, and five additional books. He's the editor of countless books, and he has also been the winner of UVA's Cavaliers Distinguished Teaching Professorship. Now, you guys probably, many of you know how we do this. Professor Gallagher will speak for about 30 minutes or so, and then he will sit down and engage in a conversation with another expert on the Civil War, who happens also to be in the history department here at the university, Professor Elizabeth Varon. Professor Varon is Langmoyne Williams Professor of American History here at the university. She's the author most recently of Appomattox, Victory, Defeat, and Freedom at the End of the Civil War, which I note won the 2014 Library of Virginia Literary Award for Nonfiction. She's also the author of Disunion, with an exclamation point, The Coming of the American Civil War, and Southern Lady Yankee Spy, the true story of Elizabeth Van Loo, a Union agent in the heart of the Confederacy. We have a lot of brain power up here today to walk us through the first year of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, and I'm very pleased to get this program kicked off. Please welcome Gary Gallagher.
Well, Will has gutted my lecture for this afternoon, as I'm sure all of you already figured out. But I'm going to go on anyway. It was going to be 45 minutes long. Now it is going to be 30 minutes long, since Will took the first part of my lecture out. Here's my beginning sentence. Abraham Lincoln experienced a unique initial year in the presidency. No other incoming president has faced a comparable challenge to the stability of the nation. You've now heard that twice. When Lincoln delivered his first inaugural address on March 4th, 1861, seven states had left the Union and established the Confederacy with its capital in Montgomery, Alabama. The future of eight other slaveholding states remained uncertain. A crisis regarding Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor simmered, and political divisions within the loyal populace remained deep and subject to great emotional swings. Yet as the president oversaw a massive military mobilization and the opening campaigns of what would become by far the most all-encompassing conflict in American history, the absence of Southern Democrats opened the way for Congress to enact parts of the Republican legislative agenda. Lincoln and members of his party often worked in concert, but sometimes the differences over how best to define the war's goals placed them at odds, especially regarding the issue of emancipation. I've written a book called The Union War. Liz has written a book called Disunion! We both think union is pretty important, and I believe the key to understanding Lincoln's first year lies in his unwavering focus on restoring the Union. All else paled in comparison to pursuit of this goal, which raised a number of questions. Could Lincoln prevent more states from seceding? We have a sense now that things were locked in. Of course, there were 11 Confederate states. Of course, four slaveholding states remained loyal to the United States. Nothing is certain. Nothing is certain at that point. And if you really want to get some sense of how things unfolded and how contingent things were, you need to shed some of what you know about the American Civil War. Many of you have heard me say this before, but don't become captive to the Appomattox syndrome. Don't start at the end of the story assuming what happened had to happen. Of course, United States victory had to come. Of course, emancipation had to come. Do not do that. Don't start at the end and then go back and pick evidence that seems to take you to the end. Really read forward in the evidence and you get a very different picture of how historical epochs unfold, and this is certainly one of them. Could Lincoln prevent more states from seceding? Could he unite Republicans and Democrats, including residents of loyal slaveholding states, in a military effort to end the Southern rebellion and bring the Deep South back into the national fold, could he negotiate a course relating to emancipation that would please both the conservative wing of his party, the radical wing of his party, and be put forward in such a way that Democrats, and more especially residents of the border states, would not be completely alienated? And would success in all these arenas, even if he succeeded in each of these things, would that still bring restoration of the Union? Although the 19th century meaning of union has disappeared from our historical memory and from our political vocabulary, Lincoln knew that most of his fellow citizens cherished what they considered an exceptional nation, a democratic republic created by the founders that featured popular self-governance and the chance, not the guarantee, but the chance to rise economically. Alone among the nations of the Western world, the United States, the Union, granted an almost universal white male franchise. Even Great Britain lagged far behind the United States in that regard. And it also allowed for singular within a Western context, social and economic mobility. Those were actually exceptionalist elements of the United States. In my world, we hate the word exceptionalism. You're never supposed to talk about any place, especially not the United States, as being exceptional. But in fact, it was, and people realized it in the mid-19th century. The new president himself was an example of how common men could rise in the American Union, and he identified what most people considered the twin pillars of American exceptionalism. What lay at stake in the war, he explained in late 1861, were, quote, the first principle of popular government, the rights of the people, and protection of a system that blocked, quote, any such thing as a free man being fixed for life in the condition of a hired laborer. That's the free soil ideology stripped down to 2 points there. There's no inherent antagonism between people who own property and people who don't. There is this ability to move from one of those categories to the other. Lincoln crafted his first inaugural address to underscore the centrality of union. That speech, devoted entirely to the unfolding political crisis, targeted different groups with varied appeals to their allegiances to the Republic. The union of these states is perpetual, the president insisted, and went on to say it was much older than the Constitution, and it had been made more perfect by the work of those delegates to the convention in Philadelphia in the steamy summer of 1787. Plainly, the central idea of secession is the essence of anarchy, Lincoln proclaimed, a violation of the sovereignty of a free people in a nation dependent upon acquiescence in rule by the majority. As a former Whig who remembered when that party had robust northern and southern wings, Lincoln mistakenly believed that large numbers of white Southerners possessed strong unionist sentiment, even numbers of them in the Cotton South, even in the states that had already left. He reached out to this supposed pro-union constituency, promising that he had, quote, no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. The Republican platform had said that as well, of course. And he affirmed that he would uphold constitutional provisions relating to fugitive slaves. Those parts of his address left abolitionists and some radicals within his party deeply unhappy. He also sought to reassure Northern Unionists with a pledge, quote, to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government and to collect the duties and imposts. And here, of course, he's reminding people of how much property had passed out of United States hands and into Confederate hands, passed very easily from the United States to the rebels. Military installations, all kinds of military hardware and other things. This had deeply offended a lot of people in the loyal states, and Lincoln is seeking to reassure them here. Toward the end of his first inaugural address, Lincoln emphasized slavery's role in the political fracturing of the nation, sought to separate secessionists from unionists in the South, and engaged listeners with an eloquent plea for union. One section of our country believes slavery is right and ought to be extended, he observed, while the other believes it is wrong and ought not to be extended. This is the only substantial dispute. Culpability for destroying the Union and possibly bringing on armed conflict, in Lincoln's view, lay entirely with the Southern secessionists. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, stated the president clearly, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. Then he offered a lyrical tribute to Union that pulled at shared memories of the revolutionary generation's sacrifice. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Now, I cannot read that passage without thinking about our current presidential campaign. There's so much language that's just like this in our campaign now. Really soaring, beautiful, touching language. It's really kind of heartbreaking, isn't it? That's my only aside. Let's drop back to the 19th century now. Lincoln continued to stress Union throughout his initial year in office. When efforts to manage the volatile standoff at Fort Sumter failed in mid-April 1861, he used George Washington's precedent during the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794 to call forth 75,000 state militiamen, quote, of the several states of the Union, to crush the Confederate Rebellion. I appeal to all loyal citizens to favor, facilitate, and aid this effort, he wrote, to maintain the honor, the integrity, and the existence of our national union and the perpetuation of popular government. There's, he comes back to one of those two pillars of American exceptionalism there. Four states of the Upper South, as we know, reacted to this plea by leaving the United States and joining the Confederacy, joining that breakaway slaveholding republic. And that prompted Lincoln to comment that Virginia and Tennessee and North Carolina and Arkansas, in those states, quote, the Union sentiment was nearly repressed, silenced. He's still thinking about a strong Union presence in those states, Unionist presence in those states. That evaluation stood at odds with the fact that solid majorities in all four of those states clearly supported secession rather than participation in a military effort to coerce the departed states of the Deep South back into the Union. Virginia's defection especially upset Lincoln. He knew that the state convention here in Virginia had voted twice against secession before his call for 75,000 volunteers. But then the Old Dominion not only joined the Confederacy, but also, in Lincoln's angry words, quote, permitted the insurrectionary government to be transferred to their capital at Richmond and to make a nest within its borders. Not only is Virginia gone, Virginia seems to now say, we're happy to be with you. Let's make ourselves the center of all this. 11 states are now gone. And with them gone, Lincoln devoted a great deal of energy to keeping Maryland and Missouri and Kentucky. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Delaware. Three of the four remaining loyal slaveholding states in the Union, as well as to framing mushrooming demands for men and materiel in such a way as to satisfy Northern Democrats. In both endeavors, he consistently highlighted the importance of union as well as the necessity of taking an array of sometimes controversial actions to save that union. It was in this way that he staked a foundational claim on citizens' loyalty. On April 15th, in the same message that called out the militia, Lincoln set July 4th as the date for the 37th Congress to meet in special session. The cumbersome election calendar occasioned this delay. Some people have accused Lincoln of deliberately not wanting Congress to be in session so he could act on his own in this period. But the calendar was very different then, as I'm sure you know. The Congress elected in November of one year didn't take his seat till December of the following year. And there were congressional elections in the odd-numbered years. A number of states had them in the odd-numbered years in the spring, which meant that all members would not be in place until sometime in June. He set the date just after that point. Once the House and Senate convened, the president sent a message discussing his actions since he had taken office. And what had he done? He'd instituted a naval blockade of the Confederacy. It commenced the enrollment of thousands of three-year federal volunteers. He doubled the size of the United States Army and the United States Navy. He'd authorized General-in-Chief Winfield Scott to suspend the writ of habeas corpus in parts of Maryland and elsewhere. All these presidential decisions prompted complaints, principally from Democrats, but to a lesser degree from conservative Republicans, about excessive or unconstitutional executive authority. Lincoln defended his actions as necessary and legal, as you well know. Creation of the Confederacy, he said, had placed an imperative duty upon the incoming executive to prevent, if possible, the consummation of such an attempt to destroy the Federal Union by firing on the Federal garrison at Fort Sumter on April 12th, averred the president, the rebels had, quote, forced upon the country the distinct issue, immediate dissolution or blood. Although preservation of the Union stood paramount, the American crisis raised an even larger issue. In language that anticipated his famous remarks at Gettysburg later in the war and got to the heart of American exceptionalist thought, Lincoln noted that the war, quote, presents the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people, by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes. And just as he would have at Gettysburg, had he spoken these words, he would have emphasized people, not the prepositions in this statement. Whenever anyone reads the Gettysburg Address in a movie or something, it's always of the people, by the people. By the who? What's that? I didn't get that last part. It's not about the prepositions, it's about the people. The people are the key for Abraham Lincoln. He consistently spoke and wrote of a union deriving its legitimacy from the people rather than from the states. In his message to Congress on July 4th, for example, he pointed out that the Union went back to the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation, and that the latter had very explicitly pronounced the Union perpetual. Having never been states, either in substance or in name, outside the Union, outside was italicized, he asked sarcastically, whence this magical omnipotence of state rights, asserting a claim of power to lawfully destroy the Union itself? The Union, he continued, and not the states themselves separately, procured their independence and their liberty. Some dependent colonies made the Union, he said, and in turn the Union threw off their old dependence for them and made them states such as they are. So he's taking on directly this notion that the states are the core for everything. It's the states. He says it's the people. Look at the preamble. Does it say we the states? It does not. It says we the people. Lincoln understood that Republicans could not restore the Union without help from the 45% of the loyal citizenry who call themselves Democrats. 45%. The Democrats are always the majority party. They've been the majority party since our beloved Tomas established the party with some friends in the late 18th and early 19th century, and throughout, they are the majority party. The only reason they're not now is because all their southern pals are gone. Otherwise, they would be. He has to work with this very large part of the loyal citizenry who are Democrats, who are not Republicans. He knew as well that only a war in the name of union could galvanize Republicans and Democrats to fill the ranks of these large national armies, pay an array of new federal taxes, and accept other burdens related to the conflict. To promote a unified war effort, Lincoln walked a delicate line regarding the issue of emancipation. Most Democrats expressed vociferous opposition to the idea of fighting a war to end slavery. And a large majority of the Unionists in the loyal slaveholding states especially balked at the idea of shedding white blood to achieve black freedom. Within the Republican Party, some conservatives echoed Democrats, while members of the radical wing of the Republican Party pushed early and often for the addition of emancipation to union as a principal goal of the United States war effort. Tensions between the president and Democrats and between him and the radicals grew during 1861 and into the first 3 months of 1862, which is, of course, where we're stopping in this lecture, since we're just going from March to March this afternoon. Abolitionists and radicals saw the war as a political upheaval that could open the door to ending slavery. Many of them hoped to tie prospects for Union victory directly to emancipation, declaring the latter a necessary tool to defeat the rebels. And we all know that eventually Lincoln is going to, he's going to present emancipation to the loyal citizenry in almost precisely that way. It's a military measure. The Emancipation Proclamation is very clear about that. How are we going to do this? Why are we going to do this? Because we need to do this to defeat the rebels. It's a military measure. It has nothing to do with morality. Wrote it that way because he understood what the radicals and abolitionists understood. That's the only thing that would resonate with most of the white loyal citizenry. The radicals, the abolitionists, would have preferred a grand moral crusade, but they understood how few white Americans would accept such an idea. And it's important to remember just how the population was distributed in the mid-19th century. Our wonderful friend, the census of 1860, tells us that the population of the free states was 98.8% white in 1860. 98.8. Black people lived in the slaveholding states in the mid-19th century. So the people that Lincoln is worried about keeping on board with the war are the overwhelming majority of the population of the North, 45% of whom are not in his party. The longer and bloodier the conflict, reasoned many abolitionists and radicals, the better the chances for emancipation. Radical Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts made this point in a letter to abolitionist Wendell Phillips following the Union disaster at First Bull Run on July 21, 1861. "The battle and defeat have done much for the slave," Sumner wrote. This letter was written on August 3rd. "I told the president that our defeat was the worst event and the best event in our history. The worst, as it was the greatest present calamity and shame; the best, as it made the extinction of slavery inevitable." A few days later, Sumner confessed his dejection at Lincoln's slowness on emancipation, observing that, quote, "the government is not what it ought to be," and pronouncing peace, quote, "impossible while slavery exists." Lincoln knew such sentiments would outrage those who sought restoration of the Union as quickly and with as little bloodshed as possible. And that group would have included Democrats, it would have included virtually everyone in the border states, and it would have included a great number of Republicans. During his first year, there are huge things happening. This war has become something that no one could imagine. It's going to get much worse, but even as it was during this first year, it has exceeded what people could imagine. There were 750,000 citizen soldiers in blue uniforms before the end of Lincoln's first year in office. The U.S. Army had 15,000 men in it in 1860. There are 750,000 men under arms by the end of 1861. News from battlefields such as Bull Run and Wilson's Creek and Ball's Bluff and Forts Henry and Donelson buffeted Washington and the Northern home front. And all of those are defeats, except news from those two forts on the Tennessee and Cumberland River. Officers such as George Brinton McClellan and Henry W. Halleck and U.S. Grant rose in prominence during this period. And it is what those officers are doing and what the armies they command are doing that absolutely rivets the attention of people in the United States and rivets the attention of the people who are running the government as well. What's happening on the military front? Against that compelling military backdrop, Lincoln wrestled with the question of emancipation. His own hatred of the institution of slavery cannot be questioned. As a private citizen, he would have joined Sumner and Wendell Phillips and Frederick Douglass and any others you want to name in that group in cheering the earliest demise of the peculiar institution. But as president, he had to balance competing political interests that came into play as the United States created and supplied armies on an unprecedented scale and dealt with the consequences of uncertainty and defeat on battlefields. On August 6, 1861, he reluctantly signed the first Confiscation Act, which freed slaves directly involved in supporting the Confederate military resistance, directly involved, digging entrenchments and so forth, directly involved. 3 weeks later, he instructed Major General John Charles Fremont to rescind an order liberating all slaves belonging to pro-Confederate residents in Missouri. Fremont's actions, counseled the president, quote, will alarm our Southern Union friends. Here he comes back again to this alleged reservoir of Southern Unionism. It will alarm our Southern Union friends and turn them against us, perhaps ruin our rather fair prospect for Kentucky. I'll remind you again, Lincoln certainly doesn't assume Kentucky is going to remain loyal at this point. He doesn't assume it. He doesn't assume what we know. And we shouldn't assume it as we try to gauge what people's actions are like in the midst of these events. The general added, the president should bring his order into conformity with the more limited reach of the First Confiscation Act. Just dial it back, General Fremont, and be in compliance with Congress. In his first annual message to Congress on December 3, 1861, Lincoln again sought to reassure all friends of the Union. The Union must be preserved, he stated, and all indispensable means must be employed. But he then set very strict limits, arguing with emancipation, at least partly in mind, quote, we should not be in haste to determine that radical and extreme measures which may reach the loyal as well as the disloyal are indispensable. We'll do everything indispensable, but let's not call things indispensable that aren't indispensable. He did not want the conflict, in his words, to degenerate into a violent and remorseless revolutionary struggle. And therefore, in every case, thought it proper, this is his language, to keep the integrity of the Union prominent as the primary object of the contest on our part, leaving all questions which are not of vital military importance to the more deliberate action of the legislature. He again has border states and Democrats in his mind here. He has to keep as many people as possible on board with the war. If another congressional law relating to confiscating slaves from rebels were proposed, concluded Lincoln, its propriety will be duly considered. Now, we all know that a flurry of congressional actions relating to slavery would reach Lincoln's desk during the next several months. Ending slavery in the District of Columbia, ending slavery in the federal territories, the only two places, incidentally, where the federal government could do it. Otherwise, the states are in control under the Constitution. That legislation would also vastly expand the reach of the First Confiscation Act with the Second Confiscation Act, and would address the status of black refugees who began immediately to move toward United States military lines at the outset of the war. But none of those things arrived on his desk during our first year in office, so forget them, because we don't know that those have happened yet. In line with his desire to court Democrats and border state residents, Lincoln insisted that emancipation in loyal states must follow constitutional guidelines. It is, to say again, it's a domestic institution, which means the states control it, except in federal territories in the District of Columbia. He sought to persuade the border states to adopt individual plans that would yield gradual emancipation with compensation for owners. The newly liberated black people, he thought, and perhaps those already free in the northern states, should be urged to emigrate, to colonize, as he put it in his December message to Congress, quote, at some place or places in a climate congenial to them. Lincoln urged Congress to vote money to help compensate owners who lost slaves and to defray the cost of colonization. His support for voluntary colonization, he never advocated forced colonization for freed people, but his support for voluntary colonization, which continued until late into the war, he didn't really give it up until March of 1864, likely stemmed from an honest belief that African Americans stood little chance of achieving anything approaching what we would call true equality in mid-19th century America. Where did he grow? Where's he from? He's from Kentucky, the state where he was born, southern Indiana, and Illinois. He grew up in those places looking around and seeing absolutely nothing that would suggest that white people would ever consider black people to be equal and work to have equal rights for them. He was a very provincial guy in many ways. I mean, that is his world. That's a world that formed him. And that's a world virtually without black people. The population of Illinois in 1860 had less than one half of 1% black people. He lives in a white world, and he sees how the other people in that world operate, and he cannot imagine a world where there would be true biracial equality. This support for colonization, I think, also represented an attempt to gain support from Democrats and others who loathed the idea of integrating large numbers of free black laborers and their families into the nation's social and economic structures. Most black Americans, abolitionists, radical Republicans, stridently opposed Lincoln's thinking about colonization. And if Lincoln thought it would appeal to the border states, it had no effect. They all rebuffed his recommendation that they draw up plans for emancipation. We'll stop where they only rebuffed once. They're going to rebuff three times in the end, and then other things happen. Apart from managing the war and dealing with issues touching on emancipation, I'm almost finished, so I'll sit down and Liz and I will chat. Lincoln and the Republicans enacted legislation that served their vision of the United States as an emerging commercial and industrial colossus based on free labor. Read their platform from 1860, and you will get a good sense of this. They got part of that platform enacted even before Lincoln came into office. Some of the Southerners were already gone, and right at the end of James Buchanan's term, they got the morale tariff just before Lincoln took office. But congressional efforts in the first half of 1862 yielded the Legal Tender Act. It was in February. The Homestead Act, I'm now transgressing our one-year boundary slightly. Homestead Act on May 20th, the Pacific Railroad Act on July 1st, the Revenue Act of 1862, first graduated income tax in United States history on July 1st, and the Morrill Land-Grant College Act on July the 2nd. All of those were passed over Democratic opposition. Banking legislation would follow in 1863. Overall, these acts brought the national government into citizens' lives in ways scarcely imagined before the Civil War. People had almost no relationship to the central government before the Civil War, almost none. Almost none. There are no direct taxes. People don't pay taxes. You don't come into contact. You get your mail. If you're in the importing or exporting business, you come into contact with the government. But otherwise, no. The entire budget of the United States in 1860 was $63 million. It's very small. It's getting very much larger in response to this seismic military event. That's something wars do. They rage beyond boundaries people can imagine in ways they can't imagine. And all of this legislation created precedents for, among other things, the modern progressive income tax and substantial federal involvement in education, huge public works. Lincoln closed his first year in office as an executive who had taken bold actions to combat a vast rebel insurgency. As you all know, Congress said, yeah, fine, to all the things he had done just before they went home in early August after that special session. Even though many of them didn't really think it was fine, even some of the Republicans, William Tecumseh Sherman's brother wasn't happy with a lot of it, John Sherman from Ohio, but nonetheless, they said, okay. He grasped the reality, Lincoln did, that only a war unequivocally waged to save the Union would inspire widespread support among the loyal citizenry of the United States. Assailed by Democrats on a range of issues, he also endured sustained criticism from radical Republicans for his handling of emancipation. The year ended with some promising United States victories out in the Western Theater, delivered by Henry W. Halleck and U.S. Grant. On March 6, 1862, 2 days past the first anniversary of his inauguration, Lincoln sent a message to Congress. If rebel intransigence continued, he remarked, quote, the war must also continue, and it is impossible to foresee all the incidents which may attend and all the ruin which may follow. Neither he nor anyone else, he said that, but neither he nor anyone else could imagine the scale of what was to come. And it was going to begin very soon. The massive bloodletting at Shiloh just 1 month hence would recalibrate the scale of military slaughter, after which 3 years of escalating political upheaval, profound swings in civilian morale, and a stark pivot toward more revolutionary outcomes more than once threatened a permanent sundering of the union. Let's talk, Liz. Thank you. We have mics everywhere.
These are working, yes. Wonderful.
They are.
All right, Gary, let's go back to Lincoln's first inaugural briefly, to that those lyrical passages you invoked, mystic chords of memory, we shall not be enemies, and so on. That first inaugural, of course, grated on the ears of secessionists and the ears of many white Southerners who were on the fence about secession. One of the leading fire-eating secessionists of the day, Robert Barnwell Rhett, said of Lincoln's first inaugural, and I quote, that Lincoln had spewed insane words full of fanaticism, brute force, and ignorance. So
some politicians would fit in the modern world.
Yeah.
Anyway, Robert Barnwell Rhett's a sort of volatile fellow.
He's a volatile fellow.
He is,
but
he
many, many white Southerners heard that inaugural mm-hmm. address as something that was anything but conciliatory. So why? Why do Lincoln's attempts at reassurance not get him anywhere?
They would have said that he's a liar. And the Republicans are liars, and they might have even put modifiers mm-hmm. in front of that. Mm-hmm. They used all the words we used, and they might have selected some juicy ones. They would have said, you want to know what he really thinks? Read his House Divided speech. You want to know what William Henry Stuart really thinks? Read his Irrepressible Conflict speech. These guys, who are now in power and pretending they don't have any design on slavery, both have said, both in 1858, that this nation is not going to continue long-term, half-slave, half-free. It's going to be one or the other. And we know, Robert Barnwell Rhett knows which way Lincoln wants it to be. Mm-hmm. So he would say he's a goddamn liar. That's what. That's mm-hmm. why I don't trust him.
All Republicans are abolitionists.
They're all abolitionists. We know that. They're all practically John Brown. They got John Brown tattoos after October 1859 of a secret handshake. We know what they really want. We do not trust them. We do not. They've been trying to stop the extension of slavery into the territories. We know they hate the fugitive slave law. He says he's going to observe all the constitutional. Mm-hmm. But what if Congress changes that? Mm-hmm. Would he want Congress to do that? He doesn't talk about that. No, we can't trust these people.
They don't represent us, they would say.
They don't. They'll never represent us. They're not even. They are a sectional party with sectional interests, profoundly inimical to the interests of the slaveholding South.
So let's then pivot to that phenomenon you invoked of white Southern unionism, or the belief on the part of the Republicans, which was a central article of faith of that party, that there was latent white Southern unionism, that if you could just disenthrall the masses from their subservience to the slaveholding elite, they would see the glories of the free labor system, maybe even the Republican Party. Does Lincoln believe that as much at the end of the first year as he did at the beginning?
I think he still believes it. He still, in his message to Congress in December, he still talks about he doesn't want this to become, I love that phrase, he doesn't want it to degenerate into, he wants to control it, keep a lid on it to a degree. He sounds like George B. McClellan. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of war George B. McClellan mm-hmm. wants to fight. There's a real problem in trying to suppress an insurrection. The British faced it in the American Revolution. How do you deal with a wide-scale rebellion? And you have a real debate among the British leaders. The Howe brothers are over on one side. We're all Englishmen, and we want them to come back, so don't smash them. Just cuff them a little bit. Cuff them around, smack them around a little bit until they realize that they should just come back. And other officers said, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. What do you do with rebels? You crush them. Mm-hmm. You crush them. Well, the same debates take mm-hmm. place in the United States, and Lincoln is still in the kind of softer war version of what he's doing here.
And they're misreading demographics, in a sense. They know that one in four white Southern families own slaves. They imagine that there must be some resentment of the slave.
And there are.
But they don't know how deeply invested the rest of the three-fourths are in the institution in various ways.
I think that they believe that, and they wouldn't have put it this way, but a kind of class antagonism between non-slaveholders and slaveholders was more important than the kind of shared mm-hmm. devotion to white supremacy mm-hmm. and white control that mm-hmm. only the institution of slavery mm-hmm. provided. That is really, whenever someone tells me, well, slavery couldn't have been important because most white Southerners didn't own slaves, that's true. But all white Southerners have a stake in social control, and that social control is provided by slavery. millions of black people whom they know do not want to be slaves. This notion, this post-war notion that slaves are happy, no, everybody knew that wasn't true. If slaves were happy, why do you need restrictive laws that maintain such fierce control over enslaved people? They knew that enslaved people didn't want to be slaves. They have in the back of their mind San Domingue. That's the great nightmare for them, a really general slave uprising. How do you control that? The institution of slavery.
There have been a small number of white Southern slaveholders who had converted to a sort of moderate anti-slavery,
absolutely.
Just a large enough number, the Grimke sisters, James Birney,
that's three.
Cassius Clay. Yeah, you can name them all on one hand.
That's right.
Sort of just enough to keep that fantasy alive.
And there are, of course, unionists. We're not saying there aren't unionists in the South. 100,000 white Southerners joined the United States Army during the war. 100,000 white men from states in the Confederacy. There are a lot of them. You go up in elevation, you generally find more unionists. Mm-hmm. That's a nice, crude way to do it. But overwhelmingly, they are the minority in the Confederate states, including in, we wouldn't have West Virginia, of course, if there weren't unionists in the South. So we should cherish that every night when we say our prayers. But so you have West Virginia, and you have evidence of unionism in other places.
Yeah.
But
a massive conversion.
This idea that these slaveholding oligarchs are holding down this great tide of unionist sentiment is a fantasy.
Well, let's get back to that question of a soft war and soft war inducements to change hearts and minds in the South. This offer, which you referred to, of compensated emancipation. Lincoln says those border state slaveholders, slavery's already being eroded by the war. Slaves are running away from plantations by the tens of thousands. You can lay claim to what the historian William Freeling has called a sweetheart deal. If you agree to voluntarily emancipate your slaves, some gradual formula, we'll pay you, indemnify for the cost of each and every slave, and then we'll pay to have those slaves sent away. The border state slaveholders refuse him again and again. Was it naive of Lincoln to keep making this case for a compensated emancipation and colonization?
Well, there I think he's actually being, as the war goes, he makes that offer several times in early 1862, past the point where we are today. So we'll cross that line. And he does it the last time in July. And each time when they rebuff him, I think he pulls back a little bit more. And in the end, he decides they're not going to go along with anything that I do.
Yeah.
And it's so much happens in July. You get the Second Confiscation Act. You get Lincoln telling the cabinet on the 22nd that he's going to issue a proclamation of emancipation, both of which are tied directly to George B. McClellan's defeat in the Seven Days Battle. The war was almost won in May and early June 1862. United States victory seemed absolutely certain. The war had gone to hell out west for the Confederates. Nashville was gone, New Orleans was gone, Memphis was gone. There were 100,000 United States soldiers in Corinth, Mississippi, for God's sake, at the end of May. The Mississippi River is no longer a Confederate river. Everybody focuses on Vicksburg as that great moment. Forget Vicksburg. When New Orleans falls, the Mississippi is not a Confederate river anymore. So it's horrendous news out west, and the largest army of the Republic is within 5 miles of Richmond at the end of May. Victory seems very close, and it would have been victory. Here's part of that. If you're at Appomattox and say, of course, emancipation is going to come, well, you know what? If George B. McClellan hadn't unfortunately ended up facing Lee instead of Joseph Eggleston Johnston, victory might well have come in July of 62 without emancipation and with little Jorge as the great Union war hero as he moved forward. And, it really was a close thing.
Really was
Seven days changed that and pushed toward more radical measures, pushed Lincoln toward them. Congress moved with it. Charles Sumner directly tied the Second Confiscation Act to McClellan's defeat at the Seven Days. And it was a good thing. This is going to stretch the war out, and the longer it goes and the bloodier it gets, the better the chance that a revolutionary act such as emancipation will be possible.
So here's a broad question. There's sort of two schools of thought about Lincoln among scholars. I'd say the dominant view is that Lincoln was a political genius who could always look around the corner. And even when he seemed to be on the wrong side of an issue, say this support for this sweetheart deal, he was really on the right side because he was just softening up his enemies and preparing to do the right thing. And then there's another view that says that Lincoln is a man who's buffeted by forces he can't control, a man pushed by the war to enact policies he couldn't have anticipated enacting. What does the first year tell us about these two interpretations?
Well, I think he doesn't anticipate everything. He makes a lot of mistakes. I think, and one of them we've been talking about, I do think he misjudges what sentiment. Well, he's not the only one. There are a lot of people in the loyal states who misjudge the degree to which the white citizens of the lower South and what we now call the upper South, the second tier of states that went out, that there was a lot more unionist sentiment there than in fact there was. So but is he buffeted? My God, yes, he's buffeted. I mean, all the presidents that you listed, Will, who are in this group, Lincoln would have said, I don't care who they are. I want their first year instead of mine, please. Whatever theirs is, I know it's not like mine. Please give it to me right now. And I'll give them mine very happily.
One unanticipated challenge he had to face on top of everything else is that briefly in the winter of 1861-62, there's talk of war with England. How did that happen and how did we avoid it?
Well, an eager American naval captain named Wilkes took it upon himself to stop a British vessel that was carrying two Confederates who were going to be envoys. It hasn't been recognized by Paris and London, but envoys to the British and the French, the famous Mason and Slidell incident, and the Trent. Pulled off the Trent, the San Jacinto stops the Trent, pulls them off, and it becomes a great, and the British say, wait a minute, we're neutrals. British loved this. They did this for years, the Royal Navy did. But now they don't like it, and they're very unhappy with it, and it blows up. London takes this seriously. They deploy a quarter of the Royal Navy to the North Atlantic. They send thousands of troops to Canada to buttress the British forces that were already, Canada is still British, of course, that it sends forces to Canada. It is a serious diplomatic crisis that is diffused in the end. Wilkes at first was hailed as a hero, and then they decided that wasn't wise. And in the end, the United States apologized and sent the commissioners on their way to Europe and so forth. And it diffused the situation. But it was the biggest diplomatic crisis of the war. And it came right at the end of 1861.
Let's get back to McClellan, who you mentioned briefly, and talk about Lincoln's generals and his cabinet in that first year. Who was meeting expectations? Who was bedeviling him in that first year? Do we see much turnover in these leadership positions as he's trying to find the right formula?
Well, his cabinet is filled with strong personalities, and one of them goes early, Simon Cameron, one of the Republican chief Republicans from Pennsylvania, goes, a person with what we might call malleable ideas about what's possible to do and what's not possible to do if you're a cabinet member. He goes and he's replaced by Edwin Stanton, who ends up being a stalwart for Lincoln and a really, I think, very good Secretary of War. He has problems in his cabinet. He never gets along that well with the Secretary of the Treasury, with Salmon P. Chase. Chase never, I think, really reconciles himself to the fact that Lincoln is president. Mm-hmm. Chase is a very unlikable fellow. I think he's a good Secretary of the Treasury. I think he's very capable, but he's eaten up with ambition and doesn't think Lincoln's as smart as he is and doesn't think Lincoln should be where he is. I think he's a problem. I think others are. I think Lincoln and Seward, in the end, work out a very good working relationship. Lincoln and Wells get along for the most part. Mm-hmm. Gideon Wells, who's Secretary of the Navy, get along very well. In terms of generals, the story of Lincoln, and Lincoln's very innocent of, he doesn't know anything about military affairs early on. We only had 30 minutes to talk. This could have been we could have had a course on Lincoln's first year. But he has to find his way militarily. He's clueless. He has a little bit of service as a captain of militia during the Black Hawk War in 1832 in Illinois. That is Lincoln's military resume. He mocked it himself. He made fun of it. He didn't know anything. And he believed early on, he was part of the chorus that said, let's just get it over with. Let's have a battle and decide this. And he pushed his generals. He pushed General-in-Chief Winfield Scott and others into what resulted in the Battle of First Bull Run. Scott actually knew something about military affairs and said, no, just because you put a uniform on someone doesn't mean they're a soldier. It means there's someone with a uniform on. So it takes a while to train soldiers. recruit, you're recruiting huge numbers of soldiers. Scott said this war is going to take a long time. It's going to take years. It's going to take hundreds of thousands of men. Lincoln had his great comment about how, yes, their soldiers, our soldiers are green, but so are theirs. And so let's have this out. Well, he learned from some of these mistakes, and he early on began to try to find someone who would apply superior United States resources, manpower and resources, in a relentless fashion. And not to kill everybody in the Confederacy, but to apply pressure consistently. And McClellan is part of that search. Mm-hmm. Poor Lincoln had no idea what he was getting in for with McClellan. McClellan takes command, builds the Army of the Potomac. He gets 3 gold stars for that. We live in a world of gold stars, of course. You get a gold star for waking up in the morning now. Oh, you woke up. Here's a gold star. Well, McClellan did an excellent job of building the Army of the Potomac. He just refused to use it. And that became very frustrating to Lincoln. He built the army in the summer. The whole fall goes by. What do you do in the Civil War era in the fall? You campaign. Campaigning is very much tied to the seasons because logistics are so difficult in the winter. You campaign in the summer. You campaign in the fall. You begin late in the spring when the rains have stopped a little bit. So a whole fall goes by. The winter goes by. Even before our ending today, Lincoln mm-hmm. finally orders McClellan to move against the rebels on George Washington's birthday. Now, who could deny that? McClellan could, that's who. Yeah. And he didn't. And it's a very fraught relationship.
Just going to get worse.
And it's just getting going because the 7 days in Antietam lie in the future. And eventually Lincoln will sack McClellan. But it's going to take a long time. And what really shows in this is that there are not... People often say, well, why didn't Lincoln just put somebody else in charge? Why didn't he just do that? Well, there isn't a room full of people who are able to command armies, just waiting for their turn to command an army. Not one person who commanded an army in the American Civil War had ever commanded more than a regiment in battle, and only one had ever done that, Joseph Johnston. He's the only one. Robert E. Lee had never commanded 5 men in battle. 5 men, no. U.S. Grant, did he? He never commanded 100 men in battle. These guys are going from being subalterns in a tiny army to being in charge of by far the largest armies in United States history. And so they have a very steep learning curve.
Sure,
and Lincoln puts up with things he wouldn't put up with if there were more people.
Yeah.
West Point didn't train generals. West Point trained engineers in the 19th century. Didn't train generals. Very little of the curriculum had anything to do with what we would call military science. It's an engineering
school. Let me ask one more question, Gary, then we'll open things up for the Q&A. You said just about any American president would trade his first year, that Lincoln would trade his first year with just about any other president. What about Jefferson Davis's first
year? Might not trade it with his.
Might not trade it.
That's a good question.
Might not trade it with Jeffy's.
Might not trade it with his. Although, at least during Davis's first year, he got a series of significant victories. Well, he got one significant victory. He has First Bull Run. But there, Wilson's Creek is a real Confederate victory. Ball's Bluff is a humiliating United States defeat, which also has tremendous political consequences. Another thing that happens in the first year is that we see, and Lincoln sees, the bringing together of the military and political spheres in a very dramatic way. After the defeat at Ball's Bluff, where Lincoln's great friend Edward Baker, after whom the Lincoln's son Eddie was named, when he was killed at Ball's Bluff, the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War was created, and much of what it did for the rest of the war, it did a lot of good things, but it also targeted Democratic generals and sort of tormented them mm-hmm. in hearings, mm-hmm. and that began here. So you get that really clear sense of in a system such as ours, these are two democratic republics at war, politics and military things absolutely flow together. They absolutely flow together, and that began very clearly mm-hmm. during Lincoln's first year in office. And Davis's too.
They both have
to appoint political figures as generals. The Speaker of the House, Nathaniel P. Banks, is an army commander. Imagine opening your paper. Oh, General Pelosi is leaving Afghanistan. No, that's what you have in place then. I'm Speaker of the House. I'd kind of like to be a major general. Okay. That happened on both sides. I hope that never happens again. I don't think it will. I don't think it will.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we're certain that you all have good questions, so we'll open up the floor now. Mics are circulating, and just raise a hand, and Gary will answer your questions.
Or Liz will.
Or I might too. Might chime in.
As Lincoln became increasingly frustrated with McClellan, I understand that he was trying to educate himself, so to speak, in the art of war. At what point did he finally say, this is just not tenable? And who did he have in mind? And kind of how was he in the process of evaluating people once he was educating himself?
Well, he evaluated people. He had people talking to him. He learned to listen to Winfield Scott, who was a great soldier. That's the best thing you could do, is listen to Winfield Scott. He's even taller than you are, so listen to him. He listened to Scott. He had communications, of course, with officers. He finally gave up on McClellan. It's a long time before he doesn't give up on McClellan until October of 1862 in the wake of Antietam, when McClellan refuses to follow up his success in the Battle of Antietam. Lee gets back across the Potomac in one night, and McClellan doesn't cross the river for weeks because he has all these things that prevent his doing so. And Lincoln very reasonably said, well, how come they can do things that we can't do? Mm-hmm. You know, they're defeated and they can do this and we're not. There's the famous, very famous, Lincoln had this way when he could, with zingers, when McClellan said he couldn't move because the horses in his army were fatigued. He must have been talking to the horses, I guess, or at least to their officers. And Lincoln wrote back and said, would you pardon me for asking, General, what have the horses of your army been doing lately that would fatigue anything? And that was the real problem. The story of Lincoln and the high command on the United States side, as it plays out in the war, is his search for an officer who will. The United States always has more materiel. It always has more soldiers. That's not enough. You need someone who will apply those things. And Lincoln finally found that person in Grant, but it took him a very long time to do it, a very long time.
And as you suggested, all it took was a very short resume to suddenly appear as a very promising
Absolutely.
Prospect.
Yes.
Pope, Burnside,
yes.
whatever,
yep.
minor
yep.
successes,
yep.
but they had to look to anyone
they
who
had,
seemed to have had any
did.
Success to you know, solve this problem.
That's right.
Hi. This idea of Lincoln's that the Union is perpetual and that the states gave up their independence when they joined the Union, how does that play? Or weren't there some states that specifically in their ratifying documents reserved the right to leave the Union if they chose to? And if so, you know, how does that play in? In your opinion, how does that play into Lincoln's idea?
Well, I know, but Lincoln would have told you that he would have gone back before the Constitution and said that you have the people in place going back long before people assembled in Philadelphia, and that if you read the actual final document, that's what it very clearly says, that that's where the power derives. It derives from the people, not from the states. The states have certain powers, but they do not have. But good lawyers, I mean, everybody in this room knows. The problem with the Constitution is it doesn't answer that question about whether states can secede or not. They're good constitutional lawyers could argue that either way and did argue it either way. It's something that was settled by force of arms. It was settled by force of arms, and then the Supreme Court stepped in late in the 1860s in Texas v. White and sort of said, well, yeah, that's right. But it really is, it's settled by armies. It's settled by killing one another. It's not clear. Even the Confederate Constitution isn't clear about that. It doesn't have a provision that says, in any time anyone wants to leave, you're welcome to leave. It doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. It does not say that.
Mm-hmm. Lincoln thought it was clear. I mean,
he did.
Know,
oh, yes, he would have said it's clear. Yeah. Others would have said, well, your glasses on.
Put your glasses on.
I had a question. You talked about Lincoln's thinking on Southern Unionists. You talked about his thinking on colonization. Is some of this that even though it's the first year of the war, he's already thinking about what comes after? Is he already thinking about Reconstruction? Is that in his mind? Does he talk about it explicitly?
That's absolutely on his mind. He wants the Republican Party to be a national party. His aspiration is always for it to be a national party. He is thinking about how you're going to put the nation back together after victory. And, you know, all of these things that... the offer, for example, of compensated emancipation, that seem in retrospect to have been so unrealistic because they were turned down, Lincoln felt this was eminently reasonable. He said the cost of indemnifying every one of these border state slaveholders is less than the cost of 1 year of funding the war. Why wouldn't people take that deal when they can see the writing on the wall? Why can't they see the writing on the wall? But absolutely, he has aspirations for a National Republican Party and for a union that's whole again. That's the point.
Even in the fall of 61, Salmon P. Chase said this war is going to cost us $1 million a day. It's going to be $1 million a day. It ends up being more than $1 million a day. So Lincoln did the arithmetic and said, yes, it would be expensive to do that, but it wouldn't be as expensive as what we're potentially doing. But it isn't, I think colonization is one of the things where that he's utterly unrealistic there. The idea of shipping millions of people somewhere else would have, it never would have flown, I don't think. No, but he maintains this kind of soft stance in his proclamation in December of 1863 when he says, we're not even, the only property we're going to alienate permanently from people is their property in slaves. We're, take the oath of allegiance and it's still a very, which, and only 10% of you have to, he had a very easy roadmap for the rebel states to get back into the United States when he offered his first public thoughts about Reconstruction there, which deeply upset the radical wing of the party and others. There's a real debate about this. And of course, if the goal is to restore the Union, then you have an argument for some kind of softer approach. But the counter would be, well, what kind? Do you want the same kind of union that got us here in the first place? Or do you want a union that is going to be inoculated against those kinds of problems? If you want that, you cannot have slavery. You've got to get rid of slavery, or this could all happen again.
I think there's also just a very human impulse on his part and on those who subscribe to this sort of fantasy of changing Southern hearts and minds to just believe that there's some possible resolutions that don't involve the killing of hundreds of thousands of more men. They cling to that because it's so difficult to watch what's unfolding.
It is, but I'll come back to the question of whether there are more people in the Confederate States who are put off, non-slaveholders who are put off by slavery, than there are people who might be jealous of planters in some ways, but are absolutely certain that they want to maintain control over millions of black people. And I think that if that's the question we could poll people on during the Civil War, we would get a decisive vote.
And, those border state slaveholders who refused the sweetheart deal, one of the things they said as they refused it was that any kind of emancipation policy is going to make Confederates fight harder.
Oh, absolutely. And it did.
And it did.
If you want to get a really good, quick read on how Confederates responded to the Emancipation Proclamation, look at Robert E. Lee's letter to the Secretary of War, Secretary of War Seddon, the second week of January 1863. Lee is a fairly moderate guy in a lot of ways. He's even presented as a kind of proto-abolitionist by people who don't know anything. But if you read his statement to the Secretary of War, Lee can barely control his anger at the Emancipation Proclamation. He says we have to do everything to avoid being subjugated by people who would take this, who would proclaim this kind of policy, a very direct reference to the Emancipation Proclamation. Lee said everything's at stake. Mm-hmm. Everything is at stake. And then he deploys a lot of the key words that you read in pro-slavery tracts from before the war about social pollution Jefferson Davis has the same kind of statement.
Absolutely.
Mike, I thought you would be first. You've waited until late into the program.
George told me not to go first. I'd like to come back to this mysterious misreading of the Southern opinion by Lincoln. We know he does it, and the question is why? Or where it comes from. And I suggested once, he worked with Southerner Whigs as young Indians or something back in 1848. But I wonder now about whether he misread the ferocious and really first, I think, public attack by Southerners in Congress against helpers impending crisis at the beginning of the 36th right. Congress, that these guys are really worried about class warfare mm-hmm.
right.
in the South.
Mm-hmm. No.
And this is mm-hmm. what may have misled him about mm-hmm. that subject.
I almost brought up Helper, Hinton Rowan Helper, who wrote a book called The Impending Crisis of the South. Helper was very much a white supremacist, but he attacked slavery as being inimical to the interests of non-slaveholding whites. It held them down. And I think there might be something to that, Mike, because the response was just off the charts, the response
yeah,
to that.
And if you wanted, secessionists offered plenty of evidence that they were concerned about the loyalty of those non-slaveholders. There were fears of northern invasion were conjured at the moment of secession, but also fears of infiltration, the Republicans establishing beachheads, using patronage, getting some traction in the region.
And the creation of West Virginia would give him further. That would give him more reason to think that maybe there was more of this going on than there was. But there, West Virginia is an anomaly mm-hmm. in that regard. And West Virginia shouldn't be as big as it is, of course. If they'd really just made West Virginia as big as the people who really wanted West Virginia, it would only have 38 counties instead of 50. Mm-hmm. They rounded it up to do certain things in the end. But there are these pockets of unionism, and some of them pretty pronounced, the hill country of Texas and western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee and mm-hmm. so forth, northern Alabama. But he did miscalculate, and Helper may well, the response to Helper may well have been part of that. The Republicans paid to have lots of copies of Helper's book printed and passed around.
Thank you so much for your talk this afternoon. My question talks about a little bit before the first year. So you mentioned that union was this big thing that Lincoln was talking about. It was all about union. But you also alluded to before the election that Southern Democrats said, look at these Republicans, they're going to get rid of slavery. In terms of Lincoln's rhetoric leading up to his presidential candidacy and kind of through his election, what was his stance on union kind of before Fort Sumter when it became very clear that union
Lincoln doesn't say anything. He said, my positions are on record. Go read the record. He didn't campaign the way we think of campaigning. They didn't make, we weren't bombarded with statements every 19 seconds from candidates then. He had a record, and he said, go look at my record. He is on record as being very much against the extension of slavery, but also against, in the long term, clearly preferring a United States that does not have slavery to a United States that has it. He's not an abolitionist. He was never an abolitionist, but he is very much anti-slavery and would prefer to have a nation without slavery in it.
And he tries to distance himself from abolitionists during that critical period you're talking about, but any of his statements can be read in multiple ways. Okay. So the House divided speech, House divided against itself cannot stand, seems in the ears of Southerners to be Lincoln saying there's an irrepressible conflict, war is inevitable. The rest of the speech says, I don't expect the House to fall. I expect it to become one thing or another. Yep. And what Lincoln has in mind, what he promises, is a peaceful evolution towards freedom. But that again, in the ears of Southerners, those are fighting words, not a promise of a gradual change.
The Republican platform in 1860 specifically repudiated John Brown, specifically said it did not have any design on slavery where it existed. That it only wanted to prevent the extension of slavery. That's in the Republican platform. Those are Lincoln's policies. He supported mm-hmm. those, but the White South didn't believe them. Mm-hmm.
I think we have time for a couple more questions. Are there any more?
For over a decade, there was increasing vitriol of denunciation not only by Southern fire eaters of the North, but Northerners saying much similarly heated things about the South. My question then is, why wasn't there a large groundswell of sentiment in 1861 saying, good riddance, the quicker they get out and are no longer contaminating us, the better. I don't see that happening.
No, it didn't happen because they believe that this comes back to understanding what union meant to them. Union meant, that in their view, and Lincoln talks about it when he talks about the last best hope of earth, they didn't just think it mattered for the United States. They didn't just think it mattered for safeguarding the work of the founding generation and all that blood that had been shed during the Revolution, but it also meant keeping alive the promise of small d democracy in a world that was going the other direction. The revolutions in Europe in the 1840s had failed. Europe's going the other way. And they would have argued that if it doesn't work here, if we cannot hold this together in the face of a crisis that is based solely on the fact that one group doesn't like the outcome of an election, they didn't say the Republicans stole the election, they just didn't like who won the election. So if the nation can't weather that, then maybe this kind of democracy doesn't work. Maybe people aren't capable of self-government. Maybe it will fall apart every time it comes to a real crisis. So you cannot risk that. It's worth keeping that together even if you have to shed blood to do that. There's both a dimension of holding together the union from which people derive things that they don't derive anywhere else in the world, and also keeping alive the possibility that maybe it would work somewhere else as well.
And talk about misreading of opinion. Southerners, Confederates, often told themselves, well, one of the reasons we can win, even though we're outnumbered, is that we're fighting for the defense of home and hearth, something very tangible, and the Yankees are fighting for an abstract principle, the principle of union. That abstract principle, there were visceral connections to that principle, particularly through the revolutionary generation and the sense that great-grandfathers and so on had fought, and that it was in honor of their memory and their sacrifice that the reunion had to be preserved and restored.
Thank you. I'm interested in some of these, the theme of the misjudgments that Lincoln and some of the Republicans made early on in the war. And my question is about something that you alluded to but didn't quite discuss at length in the in your talk, which is that there's a lot of debate among historians about the propriety of some of the legal steps that Lincoln took to keep states in the Union, especially Maryland is what I'm thinking of. And I'm wondering, basically, how necessary do you think those steps were, essentially, if Lincoln had acted differently or taken different legal strategy, would Maryland have gone?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep Maryland in the United States. Otherwise, Washington, D.C. would be in the Confederacy. So that's kind of important. And there was a great deal of unrest in Maryland, as you know, especially Eastern Maryland. And Washington, D.C. was cut off from the rest of the country for a period in April of 1860, literally cut off. The telegraphic communication cut off, bridges destroyed, and so forth. There's a real threat there. But Lincoln took steps. I mean, he did it. The president doesn't get to double the size of the army. The president doesn't get to do that. He moved money around in ways that are not constitutionally placed within his bailiwick. He can use the insurrection part to call out the militia. George Washington had already done that, as I mentioned, with the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. But he clearly goes beyond what would be, I think, termed by most reasonable people.
Trying to suppress dissent and so on.
Yeah, he did.
I would say most historians, I'm thinking of Bill Freeling here, believe that it's a myth that if Lincoln hadn't done those things, Maryland would have gone into the secessionist column, that Maryland was, in the end, strong for Union, twice as many Marylanders will fight for the Union as for the
We know that. Bill knows that now.
Yeah.
As you're sitting in Washington and can't communicate with the rest of the United States, you might have a different view
of
that.
Of course.
It really is important to try to insinuate ourselves into the circumstances. Yes, we know Maryland sent 40,000 men to the United States Army, 20,000 to the Confederate Army. So it's twice as unionists, yes, but no, it's. Yeah. I think that it's
the one word that a lot of people were thinking about, certainly in Virginia and in the Upper South and in the border states, reading back, was compromise. And certainly that was the thinking amongst Virginian delegation who waited on Lincoln in early April 1861. Yeah. How realistic did Lincoln ever think about, in his first year in office, some kind of compromise in which to end the war?
Well, I think the problem was that early on his compromise would have been, I'll talk about anything but union, you have to come back into the United States. And at that point, Jefferson Davis's idea of compromise would have been, I'll talk about anything except coming back into the United States. And then later, Lincoln said, and he was consistent in this for the second half of the war, you have to accept emancipation and come back into the Union. Everything else is up for discussion. And Davis's attitude then as well was, we independence or nothing. There's no real ground to find an accommodation.
And even those in those uncertain early days, some compromises were discussed. You know, you refer to the Virginia delegation, extend the Missouri Compromise line to the ocean, make New Mexico a slave state, pass some sort of federal amendment guaranteeing protecting slavery in the territories. Lincoln and Republicans, we know this from letters Lincoln got from his constituents, felt that they shouldn't have to seem to buy the privilege of taking office, that to compromise, make a concession to these people now, people who every time they'd been made a concession to in the past simply made a new demand, was to, in some sense, to fall prey to blackmail, political blackmail. So there was a strong sense that that wasn't reasonable.
And they had won the election.
And they would have said,
how come all the compromising comes from the side that wins the election instead of from the side that's aggrieved because we won the election? I think that part of it, I mean, historians have written a great deal about whether, not so much anymore, but they used to, about whether the North and South had really become kind of different civilizations by 1860. And you can argue that either way, things that they're alike, things where they're different. But I think the key thing is that perceptions by 1860 and 61 had reached a point where people really expected the worst from the other. Many people did. And it just made a kind of broad-based compromise, at least deep into the spring of 1861, very unlikely.
That's a good note to end. We thank you all for coming out on a beautiful afternoon and look forward to seeing you at another event.